This episode is presented by Irving Bottle and the Brooklyn Kitchen.
This week, it's the season finale of Meat and Three. We're following up our episode about youth with a look at age and how aging affects life on farms and in kitchens.
At the most basic level, we need people to grow food for a growing global population.
The question of planning for retirement or old age as a cook, it's almost one that doesn't exist bizarrely until it's too late.
We also have a story about a food that might be older than you think.
A recent archaeological finding might have CrossFitters everywhere reevaluating their diets.
Plus, a story about one of Atlanta's most historic and risque landmarks.
There are dancers that have been there 20 and 30 years.
Don't miss our season finale of Meat and Three, available wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to The Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. Our guest is Roger Trinchero. We'll talk California wines, the birth of White Zinfandel, and Trinchero wines. I'm your host, Sam Ben Ruby. Stay with us for The Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We bring wine to the people. Roger Trinchero is chairman of the board of Trinchero Family Estates. Roger started his career at the family winery, Sutter Home Winery, in 1972. Roger oversaw sales and marketing while his brother Bob oversaw winemaking. Roger and Bob pioneered White Zinfandel, and the rest, as they say, is history. Sutter Home became the top-selling premium varietal brand in the U.S. and a true industry success story. Roger also launched the family's flagship luxury portfolio, Trinchero Napa Valley. Welcome to the Grape Nation, Roger.
Thank you.
Roger, thanks for joining us. I just want everyone to know that we are talking to Roger in New York City. He's in town doing a bunch of things, which we'll get to. But Roger, first, I want to give everyone an idea of who you are, where you came from. So I think it's important to talk about the history and the impact the Trinchero family has had on wine in California and in the U.S., and then I want you to talk about the evolution of Trinchero Family Estates.
That sounds fun.
So this could take forever. We don't have forever. So you have to be somewhat succinct. But assume people don't know everything. So just give us a little history.
Okay. Well, actually, our history starts in the Asti region of Italy.
Okay.
My father was born just outside of Asti in a little town called San Marzanotto di Asti. And my grandfather had a vineyard there. And after a couple of years of severe hail, the vineyard was destroyed. And my grandfather moved the family to the coast in Savona and opened up a trattoria where he made wine for the guests. And they ran the business there. Well, as time passed, work in Italy was hard to find, and the family went other areas in France and other places in Europe to find work. And then my aunt, my father's oldest sister, she came to the U.S. and slowly began bringing the rest of the family over. So my father came over in 1923. He came through Ellis Island with his younger brother, and they set up shop, working here in New York City. My father worked in the food service business. He was a waiter initially, and then he became a bartender, and actually started making some pretty decent money back in those days. He met my mother in New York, who was working for the Renzoni Macaroni Factory, right, at the time.
Renzoni Sonaboni.
Yeah, exactly. And they got married in 1935, and my brother was born in 1936. And then my sister in 38, and then I came along as sort of the the accident of the family in 1946, which was about a year before my uncle, who was a winemaker in Paterson, New Jersey.
The birthplace of wine.
Yeah, right. And back in those days, they would go out to California, buy grapes, and then put them on a train, train them back to Paterson, make the wine. Well, he was on a grape buying trip in California, and he saw this old abandoned winery that was for sale.
Wow.
And he talked a friend of his into buying the winery. And as soon as the friend saw what he bought, what my uncle convinced him to buy, he wanted out of the deal right away. So my uncle convinced my dad to move our family out to California and to buy into this project.
How old were you?
I was 2 at the time.
Oh, okay. So, you had no
idea.
So
I don't remember much.
Right?
My brother was 12, and he remembers a lot. We came out to California. My dad came out in late 47, and then we joined him in 48. And initially, it was pretty darn rough on the family. My mother couldn't believe. We had a nice apartment on 66 in Central Park West. And here, my dad moves us out there. And for the first 6 months, we lived in a two-bedroom cabin with no indoor toilet.
Oh boy.
And she had 3 kids, and my dad and her, and my brother recalls, asked my father, said, "Why didn't you tell me this is what I was coming to?" And he said, if I would have told you, you wouldn't have come. So anyway, they stuck it out, and during the early years, we just sold wine in the local area of the surrounding counties. And
so you had the property, had estate grapes, you had the winemaking
facility.
We had no grapes.
You
contracted grapes?
We bought grapes from local growers, made the wine, and then sold it in the immediate area. Growing up, I actually grew up in the winery. The winery was kind of my playground.
Right.
It had been abandoned since Prohibition. So the tanks were dried up. My uncle and dad, would had to steam the tanks to get them to hold. Oof. Again. And then we had dirt floors back then, and it was quite a chore. A lot of people ask us why we took the name Sutter Home, and there was a very simple answer to that. When they bought the winery, the Sutter Home was painted on the roof in big, large letters. And my dad and uncle didn't have the money to repaint the roof, so they said, "Well, I guess we're going to call it Sutter Home."
I've seen pictures.
Yeah.
Now, what was Sutter Home? Was that the name of the previous winery, or was
right.
it a different business?
That was the previous winery. Initially, it was built in 1874 as the John Toman Winery. And then a member of the Sutter family bought the property, and then the Sutter brothers, who had a winery in the foothills, moved their operation there, and then they had a bottling and distilling area in San Francisco.
Right. Were there other families making wine? I mean, I know the answer is yes, but were there a lot? Did you notice them,
or was it
a small group of people?
When we got to the Valley, my brother recalls that there was probably about 15 operating wineries in the Valley. Today there's almost 500.
Right.
So you can imagine the kind of growth that's occurred in the last 70 years.
Crazy.
But back then it was basic, family ownership, a lot of whom are no longer in the business, sadly to say.
Right.
But through sheer hard-headedness, Italian hard-headedness, we stuck it out. And over the years, we began to improve our business. And
give me the ramp up. So the family gets there, literally dirt floors,
right?
Contracting grapes. When do things start changing? I mean, do you start buying property and growing grapes? I mean, just give me a quick...
Okay, quickly speaking, in 1960, my uncle wanted to retire, so my dad bought him out of the winery. So at that time, my brother had just gotten out of the service, and he was working in the winery. He took over as the winemaker. Well...
So 60 was an important year.
So 60 was the important year. That's when my brother took over as winemaker. I, at the time, was in high school, encouraged to go to college because the winery couldn't afford another mouth to feed.
Now, did anyone else ever go to college?
I was the only
one. You were the only one.
Yeah, I was the only one. And my brother was a self-taught winemaker. He learned a lot from my uncle, but he also took classes at Davis. And during the late 60s, the grape prices in Napa Valley were starting to get out of our reach in terms of what we could afford to put in the bottle. So Bob looked for other areas in California that he could access grapes, and he found this vineyard up in Amador County called the Deaver Vineyard. And he tasted some wines that were made from this by a home winemaker, and he said, we could make some fantastic wine with these grapes. So he made what would now become our first Amador County Zinfandel, our 1968 Deaver Vineyard. It was made in a Cabernet style. Up until then, Zinfandel had always been a blending grape. Or the backbone of hardy Burgundy,
right.
You know.
It wasn't a featured grape.
And so he featured it, and suddenly we got notoriety for this wine. And,
so that was the first wine
that got us any kind of notoriety outside of, you know, people coming to the winery, really.
Commodity wine.
Right, exactly. So as time progressed, we decided to start to specialize in Zinfandel. And we were making different styles of Zinfandel. We made Zinfandel Rosé. We made a Zinfandel Nuovo, you know, like a Nouveau style. And then in 1972, Bob, my brother, was trying to make a very heavy, full-bodied red. So he decided to use what is called the Saunier process, removing some free-run juice.
S-A-I-G-N-E, yes, Saunier, French
right.
word.
It means blood, right?
Right.
Bleeding. So we bled off some free run juice. To what that did was increase the skin to juice ratio of the red must, and created a much heavier, very full bodied red. Well, we were left over with this clear juice. We had about 1,000 gallons of it. We weren't sure what we were going to do with it, but we certainly didn't throw anything away at that time. So what we did is my brother fermented it. We put it in barrels, and we decided, well, we'll think of something to do with it later.
So 1973 this was?
This was 72.
72.
Yeah.
So you're going to finish the story, but this is a year that changed the wine world.
It changed us, our wine world, for sure.
Well, I think beyond you, too. Yeah. So what happens?
Well,
wine's in the...
The wine's in the barrels, and a retailer friend of ours, Daryl Cordy out of Sacramento, who is very much into wines... he came and he tasted the wine. He said, this is very unique. He said, why don't you bottle it up and I'll buy half of the production and call it Eau de Patrie, which means Eye of the Partridge in French. And we said, we'll call it anything you want if you buy half of it.
Right.
So we did. And back then I was the compliance department. So I developed the label. I sent it off to the BATF for label approval. They sent it back and they said, no, this implies a foreign origin. You have to put an English descriptor on there. So I said, okay, well, it's Zinfandel. It's white. We'll call it White Zinfandel. So I did. I sent it back.
And they approved it. At the moment, off the top of your head?
Right. Well, we said we had to describe what it was, and that's what it was. So,
right.
So we did, and... Daryl bought half the production. We sold the rest in the tasting room. And then in 1973, we didn't make it because the red grapes that year were very intense. We didn't need to use the Saunier process. And during that time, people came back and said, you ought to make that white Zinfandel again. So in 74, we did. We made about 2,500 gallons this time. And it sold out. So then in 1975... we had a little bit of a serendipity, I guess you'd call it. We were making the White Zinfandel. We decided to increase production again. Only this time we got a stuck fermentation. And we were left with a little, about 2.5% residual sugar in the wine. And it had a little pink color to it. The first White Zins were almost clear. They were very, very light tinge to them. So we said, well, it tastes really good. Let's try it. And that was like letting the horses out of the barn.
So 75 from 72 is when the real whites, that's where the color came.
Right.
The residual sugar, which I think a lot of Americans like blended reds with residual. They like whites with residual.
Exactly.
So 75, you get back in the game and...
And then it's like a runaway team of horses. It was unbelievable. We couldn't afford to, you know, to expand. So we kept producing as much as we could. And we started doubling our production every year. And it really, by the late 70s and early 80s, it really started to take off. And suddenly we found ourselves becoming a one wine winery. Here we were, right. You know, we were still making reds.
90% of your case output, yeah. Right?
We were making red Zin and we were selling it, but we were making this boatload of this white Zinfandel. And a lot of our competitors, or you call it other wineries, were saying, you're bastardizing a grape. You're taking a red grape and you're making a white, and that's wrong. But then as time passed and they saw the success that we were having, these same people started making white Zinfandel as well. So suddenly, by the mid to late 80s, you had 30 or 40 different white Zinfandels on the market, and the category itself began to just accelerate beyond belief, to the point where at one point in the early to mid 90s, there was 20 million cases of white Zinfandel being produced and sold every year.
Wow, but you had market share.
And
we had
the market share, yeah. But there were other players. And then eventually, a lot of the players fell out, and it became basically a two or three producers producing a lot, in which right. We still dominated.
Pull the curtain back for me for a second, because you were on the business side.
I was on the
business.
You
were the marketing, sales, distribution.
Right.
I mean, you saw this thing from a mistake to, you know, the color coming in 75.
Yeah, I wouldn't call it a mistake, but
I'll take that back.
Yeah,
right.
I call it luck.
So, I mean, you were instrumental in exposing, you know, this country to white Zinfandel.
I think.
You were probably working, what, 15 hours a day?
Yeah, we were working at least 7 days a week, sometimes not 15 hours, but a lot. But there was a time when we were actually bottling the wine. When the cases came, one of my jobs was also running the bottling line. And the cases would come off the bottling line, we put them right on the truck, and they'd go right to the wholesaler. We call it freeway aging. But what happened was not only did we create a lot of white Zinfandel drinkers, but we created a lot of wine drinkers.
Right.
A lot of people who didn't drink wine started drinking wine because of white Zinfandel. Now, many of them moved on to other varieties.
Right. It was a gateway wine.
It was a gateway wine. But still, a lot of people, you know, to this day, white Zinfandel is as premium as it gets. They still, you know, right. We still sell millions of cases of white Zinfandel.
I read somewhere that, you know, for Sutter, it's not something that died off substantially.
No.
This is still a very popular, large selling.
We're not selling as much as we did in our heyday, right. But we still have, you know, white Zinfandel is still a big part of our portfolio.
Right.
But something else it gave us the opportunity to reintroduce a lot of the varietals that we used to produce and that when we started specializing in Zinfandel, we kind of pushed to the side. Well, we started reintroducing, and because the power of the brand.
You had the clout.
In the
with
marketplace,
distribution, shelf space,
we introduced
consumer
Cabernet,
awareness,
Chardonnay, right. All the other varieties, and suddenly we became a national brand rather than a one wine winery,
right. Which ultimately is, you know, where you want to get to.
Exactly.
This episode is presented by LMT, the hospitality industry's preferred source for tabletop and more. From their New York City headquarters, LMT provides expertise and uniquely curated product opportunities to restaurants and hotels nationwide. Whether it's china, glass, and silver, to small wares and equipment, LMT's approach to tasteful design and product knowledge is simply unmatched. Learn more at littlemtucker.com. This episode is also presented by Forever Cheese, a passion for great taste. Forever Cheese sources the highest quality and most unique cheeses and other products from Italy, Spain, Portugal, and Croatia, and imports them to the United States, the majority under the Mitica brand. If it's Mitica, it's got to be incredible. Learn more at forevercheese.com.
Pour a drink for a harbor, a drink for a sailor whose body's now drifting the break.
All right, so move ahead a little. So that's buzzing along. 80s is going well.
Yeah.
But down the road, you expand. You know, the family name is Trinchero. Nobody really knows that because it's Sutter. Mm-hmm. Anybody who is interested or peaks maybe realizes it's the Trinchero family. But down the road, you think about launching a luxury wine portfolio. Tell me how that evolved. And
well, okay, we had already started to diversify. We bought a winery up in Amador County, the Montevigno Winery, which we renamed Terra d'Oro. And we began to develop other brands within our portfolio. And then in 1995, it was our first vintage, we decided, you know, we need to honor, my father passed away in 1982, and we wanted to honor him for getting us into the business. So we decided, you know what, we're going to make small lots of very high-end wines, and we're going to call it Trinchero, and we'll in honor of my father. Well, we did. The first few vintages we produced at our Sutter Home Winery, we had a separate right. section. We call it a winery within a winery. We had a separate winemaker and everything, and the wines were very, very well accepted, but very limited production. We got to the point in the early 2000s where we said, you know what, we need a winery, a place to associate with the name Trinchero. So we started searching around the valley for a good spot, and coincidentally, Folia Dew Winery came up for sale, and in 2005 we closed the deal on that, and we completely destroyed everything that was there and rebuilt a whole new winery, a whole new visitor center, and a whole new tasting room.
And that became the Trinchero Family Estates.
Yeah.
So that was 2004.
That was 2005 when we bought it. Our first vintage at that winery was 2007.
Now, just for a second, Folia Dew, part of the
that's part of,
family well, portfolio?
Yeah, along with buying the property, we got the brand Folia Dew, right. and we got another interesting brand called Ménage à Trois.
Which is wildly popular. They're delicious blended wines, very popular.
I talked to our sales guys, and I said, you know, I like this name. It's got a catchy name. I said, what do you think? If we put good juice in the bottle, you think we can run with it, boss? And they did. We put good wine in there. We put $20 wine. We charged $12 for it, and the brand took off. It's over a 3 million case brand
yeah,
now for
it's,
us.
It's still very popular. Why did it take you so long to launch a luxury brand?
I think mainly because we were just. I mentioned before, it was like having a runaway team of horses. You know, we were just trying to catch up with demand
right.
for the products that we had.
Right.
And we never got to the point where, a lot of it had to do with finances. You know, we needed to make money in order to do the project. But my father always told us, never take a step longer than your stride. So we never wanted to get to the point where we owed so much money,
right?
We couldn't be successful.
Somewhat conservative.
Yeah, we saw other wineries fail doing that.
Calculated your steps, but there's a lot of association and acquisition. People know Sutter; they may now know Trinchero, but we just mentioned Folia Dew, Ménage à Trois. There are other brands.
Absolutely, we have Seaglass. We have developed a lot of our own brands. We have purchased brands, and we have developed partnership brands.
Right.
We partnered with Joel Gott and Gott Wines. They have been enormously successful.
A terrific, great value, well-made
right.
wine.
Now, you know, there is a connection there because we bought Montevigno Winery from Joel Gott's grandfather. His father and his grandfather started the Montevigno Winery in Amador County. And so there was a connection there.
Right.
We've also since, we've purchased the Nyers brand.
Nyers.
Which is a very high end. And what we needed to do with all these high end brands is we needed to develop a marketing leg, separate from, you know, our big brands.
Right.
And we establish our heritage collection, which my son Carlo heads up.
Nice. And that's part of Trinchero Family Estates?
That's part of Trinchero Family Estates, right.
You guys practice sustainability.
Yes.
I mean, there's a lot of nice things about, you know, Trinchero and the world around it. One of the things that you've moved towards is sustainability, philanthropy. But talk to me about sustainability. It's such a tough thing for a large operation. What does sustainability mean to, you know, the Trinchero properties?
Obviously, in the vineyards, it means we do a minimum amount of non-organic work. We were pioneers in growing crops in between the grapevines that attract predatory
cover crops.
Cover crops,
like that.
Right?
Yeah.
That's what I was trying to say.
Yeah,
and so that part of it was good. But in terms of the production, we saw years ago the amount of recyclable materials that, you know, first of all, the actual wine production is very eco-friendly. When we crush grapes, everything is used. We use the wine, obviously,
right.
but the pumice, what's left afterwards, that's put back into the vineyards or back into agriculture, creates composting, and it all goes back. So in I guess it was the early 90s, we started a program at the winery for recycling. And what we did is we recycled everything. And with the money that we got from recycling, we established an employee in need fund. It's a fund that's a separate bank account and everything that we keep for any emergencies that our employee might have that needs help. And recently, with the Napa fires, we had 8 people lose everything, and we were able to help them bridge the time between when their house was destroyed and when they could
Great.
Rebuild.
So through sustainability, you were able to do things that created revenue,
right?
Where you created a fund, where you helped better your culture, help your employees, and then really last year, in a time of need, how did that affect you guys? Was it mostly by way of employees?
It was mostly,
was there any
mostly
physical
employees.
Effect to
you
guys?
Had one vineyard up on one of our vineyards at Atlas Peak. We had most of our crop was already in, but we did have some grapes left up on Atlas Peak that wasn't damaged by the fire, but was sprayed with the retardant that the airplanes dropped.
Right.
So we couldn't use those grapes. But you know, in the grand scheme of things, it was a very minimal loss,
right.
And so we consider ourselves very lucky.
Another
thing about sustainability, though, we entered in with our Trinity Oaks brand. For every bottle of Trinity Oaks is sold, we plant a tree. And we planted over, 11 million trees, I believe,
wow.
So far, yeah.
Wow. Last question on sustainability. Do you think, take Napa, do you think your fellow winemakers and growers have an eye towards sustainability, or they're not there?
Oh, yet? I think they are.
It's getting
absolutely
better.
Absolutely. I think everybody is conscientious about the environment.
But are they acting?
Yeah, they are. They are.
Fast enough?
Well.
Okay. There's an awareness.
There is an awareness.
More work can be done.
You know, we're farmers. We
right.
realize
in reality.
That, you got to take care of the land.
I right.
think the Dust Bowl, you know, in the 30s taught us that.
Right. It's nice to hear that you have an eye towards sustainability. I want to talk about Trinchero Family Estates because in front of us are a couple of wines. We'll take a quick taste. But on the Trinchero label, which the family name is on, that is, I guess you could say, your luxury brand, your higher end.
It is. It is our luxury brand.
You're making a bunch of different wines. It's not, you know, one or two or three showings.
Right.
You know, talk to me quickly about the wines.
Okay, what we did, we wanted it to be estate bottles, so we had to go out and get vineyards, right? And by the way, we started, I told you we didn't have vineyards in the early days. We started buying vineyards in the early 80s, and today we farm over 11,000 acres of vineyard.
So when you bought in the 80s, was that an eye towards later on?
Actually, it was a
What was the reason?
It was a deal we couldn't refuse.
Okay,
it was
so it came up.
We bought Napa Valley acreage, planted at that time. It was 1983, I believe, for $8,000 an acre. And you just couldn't.
What's the market now? You know, just give people an idea.
At least $300,000
right,
an acre.
It's crazy.
So the first vineyard we bought actually was the Mary's Vineyard.
Right. The Mary, who's Blanc, Mary?
That was my mother.
Your mom, right.
Yeah, named after my mother. And it acreage up on Bennett Lane in Calistoga in the northern end of the valley. And the Sauvignon Blanc from there is fantastic. So we've got that. But as time progressed, we bought vineyards outside of the valley to fuel our Sutter home. But then when we started to develop this brand, we said we need acreage in the valley. So we farm over 200 acres in the Napa Valley. We have hillside vineyards. We have valley floor vineyards. And we initially started producing single vineyard estate wines. And we continue to do that.
Do you blend some? They're not all
site
specific.
Well, we didn't initially. But then we found that the retail, you know, out in the consumers were confused with all these different vineyards. So what we decided was we'll keep the single vineyard for people in our wine club and people who come to the winery.
Right.
And then we developed three wines that we are actually four with the Marys. We sell the Marys, we sell the Marios. We have the BRV, which is a blend of the Cabernet vineyards from our hillside. And that stands for Bob, Roger, Vera, the next generation.
The three kids.
And then we have the Forte, which is a blend of Malbec, Cabernet. And those are the three wines that we sell out wholesale.
Right. So how many showings is that? That sounds like seven or eight different bottlings you're making?
For the single vineyards, yeah.
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 Yeah. And you acquired land as recently as when?
Well, we just bought a couple of vineyards over in Sonoma County for our Folia Du brand.
So it just keeps going on.
Yeah, well, you know, we keep our eyes open. If something looks looks good, we would jump on it.
We're going to wrap up, but I just want to ask you a couple of things.
Sure.
There was just a book published, Trinchero Wine and the American Dream.
Right.
Tell me quickly about that book.
Well, basically, it's a book. I call it a coffee table book. It's very nicely done, and it basically traces our family's heritage from the early days in Italy all the way through to
what
the present.
What you started telling is laid out in detail.
Exactly.
To the
and
present.
It, and it has beautiful photographs of our vineyards, of our people, of the family, and it's really a pleasant read.
And, so that's Trinchero Wine and the American Dream.
Yeah.
Couple other things. You relinquished your position as CEO.
Right, right.
So what are you doing now?
I'm still the chairman of the board.
Well, I know you know? I forgot to mention you're the chairman.
Yeah, but pardon me. No, I still keep an office at our headquarters.
Okay.
I go in
you're around
two or three times a week when I'm not playing golf, just to catch up on what's going on and making sure that you know, the ship's still going in the right direction.
Right.
And
we have a
wonderful CEO and president, Bob Torkelson, who's
the first non-family.
He's not a family member, but he's like a brother to me, right. a younger brother, I should say. And he's one in a million. And
okay.
I'm hoping, and I think I've got it set up that he'll be around for the next 10 years.
Great.
And maybe by that time, one of my sons might be ready to move in.
That's right. You have three sons.
Yeah.
And are they all, or a couple of them are in the business?
Two are in the business. And one, he's not sure yet. So.
Right.
And he's got that option.
He'll come around.
Well, he doesn't have to. That's the whole thing. We tell all our kids, you know, if you want to be in the business, you got to be qualified for what you do.
Right.
And the opportunity is here.
Just because you have the name doesn't
But if you
mean...
don't want to be in the business, you're still a family member. You're still a shareholder in the company.
That's not a bad thing either. Two more things. I have a thing called the wine list where I ask my guests about their preferences. You and I are going to buzz through that quickly because you're a wine guy. You've been around it a long time, so I have the curiosities. But let's tell everybody where they could find more info about Trinchero Wines.
Well, yeah.
Trinchero Family Estates
right.
Has a site.
Just Google it, and we've got
really? So it's T-R-I-N-C-H-E-R-O, if you didn't
know the spell. Trincaro Napa Valley.
Trincaro Napa Valley. And you can get the story, find out about the wines and everything else. All right. Indulge me. Quickly answer these questions. It's called the wine list. We do it with every guest.
Okay.
All right. First question we ask everybody is, what are you drinking now? And when I say that, sometimes it changes seasonally or a friend drops off some stuff. Is there anything?
I would say any bold red.
Okay. So you're the bold red guy. What's Roger's favorite wine and food pairing? Do you have one? Mm-hmm. Is there something that comes back or you eat something more with wine than other things?
You know what? I've got a sweet tooth.
You do?
I do.
And so what goes with sweet stuff, wine-wise?
I like Moscato and strawberry.
Okay. You sound like a rap singer. all right. Your favorite, and this is not to incriminate anybody. This is more to tap in. Your favorite wine restaurant and or bar. So I guess we should stay up by you. Well, who's doing it well? Who knows the wine, has the selection? You know.
Boy, there's a lot of them. Mention a few. That would be tough. The French Laundry comes to mind.
Right, great wine program.
There's a new place just opened up across from our winery called Brasswood.
Brasswood.
And they have a wonderful selection.
Nice.
In the town of St. Helena, there's a place called Cook.
Cook.
That's very good. And the thing is, in Napa Valley, in the heart of the Napa Valley, most restaurants have tremendous wine lists.
Right.
So it's difficult to pick the best. And Don Giovanni is another one in Napa.
Great, big hangout for the wine people, great wine list. All right. Do you have a favorite all-time wine? Is there a wine that to this day, what is it?
White Zinfandel.
Okay.
Stand by that.
Amen to that. All right, we ask this question to everybody. It shouldn't be hard to you, and I think the answer is kind of obvious. A lot of our listeners are younger, and they're into wine, but they don't have the money. So I always ask my guests, and a lot of guests are sommeliers, winemakers, and all that. So let me tap into you. Tell me in your mind the best wine around $15. Give me a red or a white. You can give me a varietal. You can give me
a
region. What do you think? And it doesn't just have to be, Napa or whatever.
I would say
you probably make some of these.
I would say Ménage à Trois.
Right.
We just released a Cabernet called Decadence. That's
under the Ménage label.
Under the Ménage label is fantastic, and for a white wine. It's called Ménage Gold. It's a Chardonnay. It's unbelievable.
So there you go. I mean, best wine around $15, a little higher. You're making it. It's pretty well known.
Absolutely.
All right, Roger.
You didn't expect me to plug somebody else's wine.
No. Admirable job on that. We buzzed through it. I want to thank you for sitting down with me. You have a great story, and I'm glad you shared it with us.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
If you have a question, suggestion, wine happening, or event, hit me up at sam@thegrapenation.com. That's sam@thegrapenation.com. Follow us on Facebook at The Grape Nation. Follow us on Instagram at SBenRuby. And you can now follow hashtags, so follow the hashtag The Grape Nation. And on Twitter at BenRuby. Also subscribe to The Grape Nation podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify. Write a review if you enjoy the show. Thank you to our guest, Roger Trincaro. Thank you to our engineer, Matt, and everyone at the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sam BenRuby, and you've been listening to The Grape Nation.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.